I want to take a break from the podcast right now, and I want to give you a gift. And I want to do that to thank you for being a listener. I put my heart and soul into this podcast. I love interviewing today's experts, researchers, MDs, psychologists, sleep trainers, you name it. I hope you feel inspired to take care of yourselves and your families. And I just want to thank you for being a listener and hanging out with me. So the code PODCAST10 is going to give you a one-time $10 off code at kellylevesque.com, your next order of protein powder. You can either use that on my grass-fed beef isolate protein or on my new vegan chocho bean protein. Now, here's what I love about my protein powders. It's 3 ingredients or less. So we don't use fillers, emulsifiers, no fortified vitamins or minerals. It's easy to digest and naturally made without any enzymes or chemicals like hexane. So it's 3 ingredients. With my grass-fed beef isolate, that's 100% grass-fed beef, and it's made in the way that you would make bone broth. So just heat and water. And we dehydrate that end product to get that collagen-rich protein powder that your whole family can drink. It can be added to coffees, to smoothies, and you can get it in vanilla, chocolate, and unflavored. I want to point out that my vanilla and chocolate is made with organic vanilla bean, organic cacao, and the only sweetener used is organic monk fruit. We don't use any maltodextrin. Our monk fruit is 100% ground monk fruit, and it's organic. And with my vegan line, I'm so excited to have launched this and to have it out into the world. It's a regenerative bean from South America called the chocho bean. And the chocho bean is the most superior plant-based protein powder you can get your hands on, because not only is it a complete protein, but the process is made with heat and water only. They're crushed and soaked, and what that end product results in is an anti-nutrient-free protein powder. So you're not gonna have any lectins, phytates, or oxalates in your protein powder. Makes it super easy to digest, and it's really, really delicious and robust in cooking as well. So I love it if I want a thicker smoothie or a smoothie bowl. And I also love it in my baked goods, from my cookies to my muffins, pancakes, and breads. It's the perfect protein addition. So if you want to give either of these proteins a try, or you've already been purchasing these proteins and want to take advantage of this special deal, the code PODCAST10 is going to get you $10 off for being a listener here at the Be Well by Kelly podcast. So head to kellylevesque.com or bewellbykelly.com. Put the protein you'd like to purchase in your cart and use the code PODCAST10 for $10 off. Thank you, thank you, thank you for tuning in. Today's podcast is with Sal DiStefano. He's a personal trainer and co-founder of Mind Pump Media and the co-host of Mind Pump, an online radio show and podcast that is dedicated to providing truthful fitness and health information. He's also the designer of the Muscular Adaptation Programming System, or MAPS, and the author of The Resistance Training Revolution. Sal is dedicated to prioritizing health over appearance, and he aims to shift the direction of fitness industry from aesthetic and insecurity-based to one based in self-love and self-care. And that's why I love him. So let's bring Sal on to the show. Sal, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on. And we just talked earlier, so we have some friends in common, which is kind of cool. So two of my favorite people know you very well. So
I know Max Lugavere and Becky Campbell both have been podcast guests prior to you. And Max has been on a couple of times. And it's good to be in the company of good people.
Yeah, thank you. I feel the same. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I went down a rabbit hole after Max told me about Mind Pump podcast and realized that you've taped thousands of episodes. So you are a true expert, but I'm curious, how did you get started in health and wellness? And when did you decide to become a trainer? When did it all start?
Yeah, you know, as a kid, so I started working out real young. I was 14 years old, and I got into it, I think, for the most common reasons most people start working out, maybe some insecurity, right? Body image issues. And so I started lifting weights. I was a skinny kid and I fell in love with it instantly. It was like this very empowering process. It was something that I could control and learn. I got really nerdy about it, which, you know, for anyone who listens to my show knows I do that about things I'm into. So I started reading everything I could, nutrition books, fitness books. I even went to the library and found old, you know, Soviet era studies on strength training and stuff. It was really cool. Great time. And I knew pretty quickly that I wanted to work in the health space. I didn't know what, you know, because I was a kid, right? I didn't know what careers look like. So I thought physical therapy, that was really the only thing that I knew at the time. And I said, okay, this is what I want to do. At the time I had joined a gym and I loved it. And I knew that I could be a trainer there. And I thought that would be a great job to have while going to school for physical therapy. So as soon as I turned 18, which was the minimum age, I introduced myself to the manager, got hired, and fell in love with it. Within a few months, I was managing the fitness department. By the time I was 19, I was grand opening, you know, big box gyms. And I took at the time, I said, I'm going to take a year off school to see if this is what I really want to do. And I never went back. I love the gym atmosphere. I love that people are there because they want to be there versus the clinical setting where sometimes people are there because they have to be there. And it was just such a great experience. And I did that for a long time. I did that for over 2 decades. And I eventually met my co-host that I have now on the show, Mind Pump, Adam Schaefer and Justin Andrews and our producer, Doug Eggy. Doug was my client as a trainer. Later on, I had my own private studio. It was a wellness facility. And I was a trainer. I had other trainers there, but I also had massage therapy and I had gut and hormone testing there and acupuncture. And, even though I was at that time, more of a fitness performance, maybe meathead type of trainer, I understood macros and I understood, you know, exercise. I at least understood the value in the well-rounded approach towards health and fitness. And what was cool about this for me personally, which I didn't anticipate, was being surrounded by people from different parts of health and wellness. I learned a tremendous amount from them just through osmosis, just through observing. I had a physical therapist in there and I would watch her, learn so much about correctional exercise. The acupuncturist, I learned so much about how the body reacts to different stimulus and Chinese medicine, which is a totally different philosophy from Western medicine. I saw value there. Gut and hormone testing. Personally, I learned a lot from that. I developed some gut issues, really bad gut issues in my early 30s. Turned to the person who was in my facility, was a gut health expert, and I had to completely revamp my nutrition. So I learned a lot through this process. And of course, as a trainer, you know, anybody that works with people to improve their health, if you really love people and you really want to help them, you eventually learn the right way and what's effective, because you go into it with an idea. And my idea came from a fitness fanatic mind, which was me. And now I'm dealing with everyday people who aren't necessarily fitness fanatics. And, you know, you start to figure out, well, this isn't working. Why aren't people staying? You know, I can get them to lose 20 pounds. Why can't they keep it off? Right. And I thought, well, maybe they're not disciplined. And then I said, wait a minute, these are successful executives and, you know, consistent people, and they're good people. It can't be necessarily a discipline issue. Maybe it's my approach. And so you just start to figure these things out. Well, later on, I met Adam and Justin, who were also trainers for a similar amount of time, about 2 decades. And we sat down and it was incredible chemistry. And we just, for 4 hours, we had this great conversation about everything that was wrong in the fitness industry and, you know, what we think should happen. And we said, we should start a podcast. There's a low barrier to enter. It's really easy to get started. We're not going to have to be beholden to sponsors, so we can be very honest. You know, the fitness space is often, much of the information that's put out there is promoted in order to sell products either directly or indirectly. And we were privy to that and we're like, cool, we could start a podcast and we don't have any sponsors. We could say
whatever you want.
Yeah. Most supplements don't do anything for you, or, you know, this advice for diet is just to get you to buy protein powders and whatever. And we did. We started the show, zero media experience. And you can hear it in our early episodes. Before we started, you made a joke like, hey, we should go back and listen to your early episodes, see how much you've changed. Don't do that. We were terrible.
Where do people start then? Yeah. What episode do you want them to start at?
Just listen to the recent ones. And if you're
backwards.
And if you fall in love with us, then you can go listen to the old ones, because then you'll forgive us. But we weren't media people at all. But we were trainers with 2 decades of experience. And so what you hear on the show, and now it's more polished, but this core is the same, is how to effectively communicate health and fitness. And there's a few components to that. One of them is you have to be somewhat interesting to listen to. As a trainer, if you're not interesting, if people don't look forward to seeing you, you can be the best trainer in the world. You're not going to be effective, right? So we learn that through training. So when you listen to our show, there's an entertainment component to it. We also learned as trainers that the mechanisms behind weight loss and muscle gain and, you know, improving your fitness, as interesting as those are, the science and the breakdown and the macros and the calories and all that stuff, as interesting as that is, that's not an effective way to communicate to the average person. If you really want to really impact the average person in a way that makes so that they can make lifelong changes for the better, you have to speak to behaviors. And it took me 5 years as a trainer to figure this out, a failure, right? To figure this out. And so again, you hear that on the show as we talk about behaviors, because that's, humans operate through behavior. We don't operate through just information. Information can influence behaviors, but if you don't speak to behaviors, then, you know, obviously we're at where we're at now, where, you know, almost everybody fails at long-term success through the traditional approach to weight loss, for example. So that's how it started, and it struck a chord and it grew, and it's great. We love it. We love what we do. We love that we're impacting people. We have a lot of fun doing it. And so that's where I'm at now.
Well, you're changing lives, and I love that your whole podcast squad has so many years of experience, because what you just highlighted has been key in what I've learned over the last decade working with clients. Is I can geek out on all kinds of hormones and what, you know, macros or whatever it may be, but really it's those habits and those behaviors that change someone's life. And you highlight that a little bit in your book, The Resistance Training Revolution, where you talk about people who have no time, this idea that they have no time or that they can be toned. I loved how many insights you gave in the book about really just giving people the science, but then talking about behaviors. So can we talk a little bit about how mindset and behaviors can like affect someone's success? You also talk about cheat meals versus, and like how that might derail someone. So
let's start with the time issue. And there's definitely accuracy to how many coaches and trainers communicate the time issue. It's just not effective. That's the problem. So again, if you're trying to help someone, you have to think, well, what's my desired result? Is my desired result to prove this person wrong or to get them to take action through extreme motivation, which fades, motivation fades. Or is my goal to get this person to a point where this is something that they can do for the rest of their lives, that they have a really good relationship with? And that's my goal. My goal is to do that, right? So the time issue is a very common one. And this is like, you know, give you an example. Let's say I get a potential client. They come in for an assessment, you know, with me. I'm a trainer in the gym. And, you know, the concern is, I don't know if I have enough time to work out enough to really make a difference. Now, I could go the motivational route, and I would do this early in my career where I'd say, we all have the same 24 hours in a day. And, you know, the time you put into your health, you'll get back into productivity and you'll feel better. And, you know, I know you have kids, but if you're fit and healthy, you'll have more energy to do this, that, and the other. And that's all totally true, but so ineffective. Now, what'll either happen is, one, the person's going to listen to me and say, you have no idea. Mm-hmm. So no, I'm not doing this. Or two, I may be effective at motivating them and inspiring to go to take them from no days a week to the gym to now doing 4 days a week. Then the motivation fades like it always does, and they stop, and I've totally failed. So instead, I would say, well, how much time do you think realistically you could commit right now to exercise to improve your health? And there's no wrong answers. And then I don't care what answer you give me. I can do 30 minutes a week. Okay, that's what we'll start. I can do 1 hour a week. That's fine. We're going to start right there. And I know, first off, that anything is better than nothing. I also know this as an experienced coach. If I do a good job with your 1 hour a week of exercise and I train you appropriately, you're going to start to notice things and you're going to start to feel better. And then it's just a matter of time. And this is the truth. It is just a matter of time before the person themselves starts to value it a little more and wants to put more time into it. Worst case scenario, they stick to 1 hour a week for the rest of their life, which is more than 0 hours a week. And it's really just two different ways of communicating, you know, that particular issue. And then the other side of this is, when it comes to exercise, the value that exercise brings to your body, there's lots of values, okay? But a lot of the value, at least the physical and physiological values, come from the adaptations that the exercise induces in the body. Now, there's definitely value in the fact that you take time for yourself. There's lots of value in going into it with this self-care attitude. I'm doing this to take care of myself. There's lots of value in the fact that you're just moving. But if we're looking at the physiological effects, the fat burning, muscle building, improve my health, hormones, mobility, that kind of, that's about the adaptations that the exercise provides. And any adaptation system in the body is, it gets triggered by doing, by creating more stress than you're already used to. Okay. So to put it plainly, if I'm doing zero exercise, a little bit is enough to get my body to change. So, and here's the other side of that. Too much of a stress overcomes my current body's ability to adapt. In other words, if I go from 0 to 5 days a week, my body cannot adapt. It only can focus on healing. That's the primary concern at that point. It's just going to heal. And you get stuck in this hamster wheel of, you know, work out hard, get real sore. I'm not sore. Work out hard, get sore. I'm not sore. And you don't improve. Like, why am I not getting stronger? Why is my body not improving its fitness? Well, because your body can only heal. You're not allowing it an opportunity to adapt. And that's very individual. So if you're just getting started, it's the right dose will get you there the fastest. More than that, you'll get there slower or not at all. And a lot of people don't realize that. It's like a, it's almost like a bell curve. Like the nothing gets you nowhere. The right dose gets you the best results. Too much also will get you nowhere. And that bell curve moves depending on your current fitness level. And if you're doing nothing or little, doesn't take much, doesn't take much at all.
Okay. So when someone says that they've hit a quote unquote plateau, but they maybe, let's use an example like OTF or Barry's Bootcamp, or maybe they're just doing a cardio type soul cycle or Peloton type of a workout. How can people hit the top of that bell curve, start to see some adaptations in their body from that, like from a hormetic effect, like to create muscle in their body, to see changes and to, you know, get the best benefit? What's your advice?
So it depends on the person, but usually when someone is referring to a plateau, when I'm talking to the average person, what they're referring to is a weight loss plateau. Okay. Yeah. That's the most common. Okay. So right. I was losing weight and then my body stopped losing weight. What is going on? And it's usually due to the way the person, the types of adaptations that they were inducing that they maybe weren't aware of. They went into it with the wrong approach. So I'll go a little deeper into that. So when it comes to weight loss, what I'm about to say is true. Now, it also is oversimplification. It's much more complex than what I'm about to say. But nonetheless, what I'm about to say is totally true, and we can't get around it. It's a law of physics. And that's this. In order to lose weight, you have to take in less calories than you burn, or take in more, or burn more calories than you take in. So you have to create this imbalance. That imbalance, your body is, obviously it's burning 2,000 calories. You're eating 1,000 calories. I don't recommend that, but let's just say you are. That extra 1,000 calories is coming from tissue. So you start to lose weight. And that's very, very true. Now, the problem with that understanding is people say, or I should say, the general consensus or the mainstream approach is, okay, we got to burn more than we take in. So we'll eat less. And then here's the other side of that. Let's look at exercise and let's value it based on its calorie burn. That's the number one value of exercise. How many calories do you burn while you do it? And I get the rationale if you don't understand adaptation. That makes perfect sense. But here's the problem. The highest calorie burning workouts tend to induce adaptations that eventually lead to a plateau and put you in a place where it's impossible or very challenging to maintain. So I'll be more specific. A very high calorie burning activity might be circuit training class, or, you know, you said Orange Theory, or running. Let's go running, right?
Cardio.
Yeah. An hour of running or an hour on the Stairmaster will burn more calories than almost any other form of exercise in the same period of time. But again, we're ignoring the adaptations. What am I asking my body to do and to improve upon to make me better at running? I need lots of endurance. That's true. I don't need lots of strength. Okay, which is also very true. You don't need lots of strength at all. And because I'm burning so many calories, my body's going to learn how to become more efficient with the calorie burn. So your body's always trying to get better at what you're asking it to do. So since I don't need a lot of strength, And since I need to become more efficient with calories, it's very easy choice for your body. Pare muscle down, reduce muscle mass. This will slow down the metabolism. This will make you a more efficient calorie burning machine. So when you started your program and you said, I'm doing this running because it burns so many calories and I'm cutting my calories and I lost 10 pounds, what ended up happening is your body learned how to burn less calories. That's why you plateau. So now you're stuck in this position where you're doing, I don't know, 3 days a week of running and you're eating significantly less calories. You lost 10 pounds. Now you're stuck. And not only are you stuck, you got another 20 pounds to go, but you got to keep running 3 days a week and eating a little bit just to maintain that. Mm. So now your options are, what most people do is they'll do more running and cut food even more. And now they lose the next 5 pounds and they plateau again. Oh my God, what do I do? Well, if you're really, really hard-headed and tenacious, you do more cardio and you cut your calories even more. So now you're stuck in this position where you lost 30 pounds. You're eating 1,200 calories a day. You're doing 5 days a week of cardio just to maintain what you did. And that's hard. That's hard to maintain, especially in the context of modern life where we are surrounded by hyper palatable, easily accessible food. It's everywhere. It's inexpensive. We do so many things with food. We connect over food. We have events, you know, we go out to dinner with friends and whatever. And it's just 1,200 calories a day, you know, 5 days a week of cardio to maintain. That's really, really challenging. So instead, what I write about in my book is an alternative approach. And I say, look, the best possible thing we can do in the context of modern life is to find a way to get your metabolism to burn more calories on its own. If we could do that, then just sitting at your desk at work, you'll burn more calories than you were before. And the best and most effective way to do that is through the muscle building process. And I say through the muscle building process because it's not just having more muscle that gets you to burn more calories. It's also sending the signal to your body to build muscle that does so. And the reason why I say that is because there are, I've had this before, people go, well, I read a study that shows that, you know, a pound of muscle only burns another 10 calories a day. So it's not really that much, which, by the way, an extra 50 calorie burn from 5 pounds of muscle, do the math over a year, it actually is significant.
Yeah.
But it's much more than that, because the body has a range of calories it will burn with your current lean body mass, and it can move to more efficient or less efficient depending on your activity and the signals that you send your body. So if we do this alternative approach, and we say, okay, instead of picking the form of exercise that burns the most calories, let's burn the one that let's choose the one that builds muscle. So we're going to do strength training. Strength training builds muscle. And let's also feed the body in a way to build that muscle. So we're not going to cut calories real drastically. We're going to obviously make good choices, but we're going to feed that muscle building process. Well, here's what ends up happening. The weight on the scale doesn't move as quickly initially. And by the way, mostly this is because you see initially this body composition change. So you may have lost 4 or 5 pounds of body fat, but you might have replaced it with 4 or 5 pounds of muscle. By the way, you're smaller. I want to make that clear. Muscle muscle takes up about maybe a quarter less space roughly than body fat. So if everybody lost 10 pounds of body fat, gained 10 pounds of muscle right now, they would lose about a quarter of their size roughly, maybe a little less than that, right? But they would lose size. So the scale didn't move, but you're a little smaller. But then here's what happens. My metabolism is faster. I'm burning more calories all the time. I've got better insulin sensitivity, which is a hormone that, you know, can work very well for you if you're very sensitive to it. And you notice that the fat loss starts to accelerate. You get more of a snowball effect. And now this is a very real scenario. I've done this many times with clients where you could lose your 20 to 30 pounds, but at the end of this journey, you're eating more than you did when you started. I'm actually eating more to maintain a lighter, leaner body than I did when I started, which is the opposite of what people end up doing. And there's a lot, this isn't just my anecdote. Even though I've trained lots and lots of people, this has been shown in studies, quite proven. In fact, my favorite studies to show this are the ones on the contestants on The Biggest Loser. You read up on these contestants, right? These are people that go on a game show, the goal is to lose tons of weight, and they do so through ridiculous, rigorous exercise, all cardio-based and focused. By the way, I know they use weights, but you can use weights and make them cardio too. So when I talk about strength training, it is using weights or resistance bands, machines or body weight, but it's in a way to build muscle. So, because I can use them in a way to, it's just like doing cardio. I might as well be running. That's what they do on The Biggest Loser. They cut their calories, lose tons of weight. And afterwards, they're stuck in this position where I'm eating 1,200 calories. I'm doing tons and tons of activity and just to maintain. And if I go off that, man, the weight comes on so fast, so fast. So the approach that I talk about, again, is what's the most, what's going to be the most sustainable for the average person? The non-fitness fanatic, the person who probably, if you average it out and they do a good job and they're consistent, is going to work out 2 or 3 days a week and no more. That's just the most we could hope for. Mm-hmm. Well, what I'm going to have them focus on is strength training. I'm going to have, and with nutrition, we're going to focus on behaviors. And in that, for me, has led to the best long-term success with clients.
Oh, I feel like I want to just say hallelujah from this side of the computer, because, you know, I always think that calories backfire, and it's, and I'm just saying, because most people, it's low hanging fruit for them. So they do exactly what you say. They're like, I got on the treadmill or the pre-core and I burned 200 calories and I know that my body burns this much. And so I'm trying to be depleted. But at the end of the day, they're starving. They have muscle atrophy. Their metabolism is lower than when it started. And what I think you so eloquently stated was that there is a world in which you have a snowball effect and you get the weight loss that you're looking for. You have metabolic like weight on your body in the form of muscle, which is so glucose hungry. And you're able to eat more, which I think is pure food freedom. Because the reality is, like, as you know, as a trainer and as I know as a nutritionist, when you have a client, they're not perfect. No one is perfect. Like, if you think that you're a robot that can just stick to your caloric intake and never, you're never going to be able to eat out, and you can't trust some of the packaged foods that people are eating. And yeah, I just,
no. And who wants to live that way? Like, you know, in the fitness and health space. And I remember when this really dawned on me, I see more, and this is true. I'd make this bet all day long. There's more dysfunctional eating in the fitness space than there is in the general population. Now, I know they look fit and ripped and all that stuff. There's a lot of orthorexia. There's a lot of stress around eating. Got to eat the perfect amount of proteins, fats, carbs. Got to eat the perfect amount of calories. And what they're doing is their health is actually suffering as a result, even though they look like they're fit and healthy. There was a study that was done out of, I think it was Harvard, might have been Harvard, where they showed that having poor relationships with the people around you was as bad for your health as smoking a pack of cigarettes a day, right? So I know a lot of fitness people who are so obsessed about their diets that they don't go to birthdays. They don't really have any meaningful relationships. Everything revolves around the obsession of their diet, and they're robbing one side to pay the other. And that's not what I'm advocating for either. I want people to have a stress-free relationship and nutrition. Now, there's more to it than what I'm about to say, but one component of that is having a faster metabolism. Like, having a metabolism that burns lots of calories was a liability, you know, 100,000 years ago. Like, you know, if I'm a hunter-gatherer, I don't want a metabolism that burns 3,000 calories a day. That's going to be really hard to find. Mm-hmm. But today, it's an asset. If I could snap my fingers and increase everybody's metabolic rate by 50%, I'd solve obesity, right? I'd solve it. It'd be no problem. Even here's the crazy thing, you know, and you know this because this is your background. Even when you look at harmful foods like processed sugars, okay, and you look at the effects, the inflammatory effects on the body and the detrimental effects on the body, a lot of that is negated when you're not eating more calories than you burn. Not all of it, but a lot of it. Like, it makes it, like, there's even, and I don't like this either because I think this oversimplifies it, but you see these professors who will, to prove a point, they'll go, I'm only going to eat McDonald's and I'm gonna lose 20 pounds and improve all my blood markers. And they do, but that's because they ate less calories than they burned. So there's a lot that you can, I guess, for lack of a better term, fix by being able to burn more calories. Now, it's more, there's more that goes to that than what I just said, but a lot of it, that makes a big difference. So if you could just get a faster metabolism, you work out less, you burn more calories, you have more flexibility in your diet, you can get away with the weekend with your spouse and the party and, you know, because, you know, here's the deal about with food. Yes, it fuels your body. And yes, it contains nutrients, micro and macro, that are either essential or improve your physical well-being, your mental well-being. But food is much more than that, isn't it? Like, food is also connecting with friends. Like, is there value to sitting down with a group of friends that I haven't seen in a while, having some pizza and some beer. Yeah, they're totally in, right? Is there value to going to my mom's house for Sunday dinner? My family's Italian. I go to my mom's house and she made her homemade lasagna. Yeah. Am I going to say, is there value to eating that? Well, yeah, there's some value to enjoying that. It's not the physical, maybe physiological benefits necessarily, but there's a lot of other benefits that also contribute to health. So we have to communicate to those things right there. Otherwise, we're going to lose the battle. We're going to lose this, which is happening. We're losing the battle of helping the average person navigate this modern world. And it just doesn't work with the numbers approach. Doesn't work. We got to stop doing that and stop promoting that.
I completely and wholeheartedly agree with you. The value of sitting down with family, breaking bread, super important. But you made a great point, and that was that when we're at a caloric deficit, those things that may create inflammation, that may break down, those processed foods that break down to simple sugars, when they're able to be used as fuel, they're being pulled out of blood circulation and decreasing advanced glycation end products, which is that mucking up and the inflammatory process that comes from that. So even though that is a sneaky way of getting away with it, I think what I love about you the most is that you're promoting promoting the increase in metabolism, the building of muscle. I speak primarily to women between the ages of 25 and 55, 95% of my community are female, and they want to feel their best. They are busy moms, they're entrepreneurs, they're ultra marathoners, you name it, it runs the spectrum. But a lot of women are afraid to lift weights, and they're afraid because of what you mentioned. They lift weights, maybe they're holding on to a little bit extra water weight, maybe they haven't burned off the fat yet. Can we talk about that snowball effect, how long it takes and what you recommend for women who are looking to go up that bell curve, hit the top, snowball down with the benefits of weight loss or their body composition change that increases their metabolism? Where do we start? Can we debunk the weight thing for women?
Yeah. So, one of the motivating factors for starting our podcast was that the popular fitness media, fitness and health media, right, which encompasses the diet industry and the fat loss industry and the muscle building, 90-something% of the information was just terrible. It was wrong and it was terrible. And that's part of what motivated us. But I'll tell you something, the damage that the fitness industry, or I should say the popular fitness industry and diet industry has done to women is the worst, absolute worst. The lies that they've promoted have really created not just a lot of confusion, but have actually pointed women in the opposite direction, to the point now where, like you mentioned, now it's a lot better today than it was when I first started, but it still exists where women are, they're afraid of lifting weights because why? I don't want to get big. Let's talk about that first. Building muscle is not an easy process. It's really hard. Okay. And whether a man or a woman. You're not going to get too big. It's just not going to happen. And here's why. It's largely the amount of muscle you can build is largely controlled by your genetics. You could work out like a bodybuilder. You could eat like a bodybuilder. And if you don't have those bodybuilder genetics, you're not going to look anything like them at all. You're not going to build anywhere near the amount of muscle that they have. So the question is, well, who does build that? Because I have seen women on social media or magazines that look just insane and extreme and what's going on there? Okay. So if we look at the spectrum of genetics for muscle building, on one end you have, muscular genetic issues, right? Strength issues, issues that need to get treated medically. So that's way over here. And then way over here, you have the super muscle building genetic anomalies. 99% of us are somewhere in the middle. 99, probably 0.9%. So to illustrate this further, if we use the same graph and I put height on it, on one end you have dwarfism, on the other end you have NBA basketball players. Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. Barring if you've ever gone to a professional basketball game, how many times have you seen in real life a 7-foot tall person?
Maybe less than a dozen.
Yeah, and you remember almost every single one. Yeah. So it's so rare, right?
Right.
That's how rare 7-foot tall genetics are. It's extremely rare to the point where, I'm 43. I remember two times, right? One time was at the airport, another time was at a restaurant. Stood out. It's holy cow, that guy's so big, right? That's how rare the muscle building genetics of bodybuilders are, whether they're female or male. And if you have them, you know. And what I mean by that is you're not like, oh yeah, I've got kind of muscular legs. Or, no. You know, you're like the strongest person always ever. You don't work out. Like it's insane-o.
Yeah. And annoyingly, my husband, but that's okay.
So that's how rare that is. Okay. So you don't have that. Number two, a lot of those women not only have those genetics, but they also take lots of male hormones to look that way. So what does this mean for the average person, the average woman? For the average woman, what lifting weights will do is you'll build a little bit of muscle. You might build 5-6 pounds of muscle on your body, spread over your whole body. You're not going to get any bigger. Remember, I said muscle is very dense. Even if you gain 10 pounds of muscle, you're not going to look any bigger. You'll feel tighter. You'll have a different shape to your body. Muscle looks really good. It lifts the butt, gives you hamstring curve. It makes your arms look sculpted, gives you better posture, that whole thing. But you have this much faster metabolism. And then here's my favorite part about all of this. And this is a great selling point. And I know, by the way, that in order for me to get the right information or to get people to adopt the right information, I have to sell it better than the people sell the wrong information. Okay.
So sell me on the muscles. Let's do it.
I'm going to sell you. And I'm not, and this is all true. Okay. When I send this signal to my body to build muscle and it's fueled properly and I have good sleep and everything, and my body is in the position where it's going to try to build muscle, before it builds muscle, it has to organize its hormones in a way to do so. Okay. So now let's think about the hormones that are optimal, or the hormone profile that's optimal for muscle building, okay? In men, high testosterone, sensitive to insulin. We have good growth hormone levels. Cortisol is appropriate, right? It rises in the morning, drops at night. I don't have this high cortisol all day long. In women, you have this wonderful balance of estrogen and progesterone. Women also, testosterone, very important women. Much smaller amounts, but also very important. So we get good, healthy testosterone levels in women. We have good growth hormone levels. Cortisol is appropriate. What our body did is it organized its hormones in a way to add this active anabolic tissue, right? Muscle, to add muscle to our bodies. So it gives you a youthful hormone profile. We're all looking for that. I want that youthful hormone profile. Well, one of the best ways to do it is to tell your body to build muscle. And again, not my anecdote, proven study after study. Like, we'll just talk about testosterone, for example. Resistance training, proper strength training, is the only reliable form of activity that will raise testosterone in men, regardless of where their testosterone levels are, okay? Now, when I worked with women, when it came to hormone issues and hormone imbalances, I had a hormone specialist in my wellness facility. And let me tell you, their hormones always balanced out when they got stronger. It was like, if I saw them getting stronger in the gym, I would go talk to my hormone specialist who was doing the hormones, and I'd say, you know, Susie just added 15 pounds to her squat. Let's look at our hormones and say, oh yeah, no, everything's balancing out. Like, it's hard to build muscle. It's hard to get stronger and have a unhealthy hormone profile, right? Now, we talked earlier about activities that make me pare muscle down. And I'm sure you've seen this in your practice, like excessive cardio, cutting calories. So the body pares muscle down to slow the metabolism down. Well, your body also organizes its hormones in a way to do that. High stress hormones, low anabolic muscle building hormones. Because otherwise, you know, how would your body pare muscle down if your growth hormone was optimized? It wouldn't, right? It would just raise cortisol through the roof. Estrogen and progesterone wouldn't be very balanced. You'd see low testosterone in women, definitely in men, because your body's trying to pare muscle down. So strength training does that. It builds lean muscle, which again, you're not going to get too big, organizes your hormones in a way that are youthful, I guess, for lack of a better term. You get a faster metabolism. So now you can eat more and be leaner and maintain it, by the way, much easier. Let's talk to that for a second. There's no permanent results from exercise. Okay. So let's be clear. However, the closest you can get to permanent results through exercise is through the muscle building process. There's something very interesting called muscle memory. Well documented. This is a well documented phenomenon. So if you gained, let's say it took the average female, she hired me, I trained her, we did a good job. In her first year of training, we gained 7 pounds of muscle, which is, I would say, a realistic amount of muscle to gain for a woman in her first year. After that, it really starts to slow down, but 7 pounds of muscle. in her first year. And then let's say something happens for whatever reason. She just stops working out, becomes very sedentary, loses all 7 pounds in the next couple months, lost it. And then she comes back and she says, Sal, I need to get back into it. I need to start training again. I lost all 7 pounds of muscle. She'll gain that 7 pounds back within a month or two. It took her a year to gain it the first time. The second time around, it's like a couple months and it comes back. That's the result of muscle memory. This is why people who have a good amount of strength and muscle can take time off and not notice, at least in the short term, all of a sudden this crazy fat gain. It's like, oh, I haven't worked out for a month and my body kind of looks the same. And then if they stay inactive long enough, eventually they start to notice muscles start to go away and they start to gain body fat. And then they go back to it and it's like, whoa, my body got in shape real fast, right? That's an incredible feature of strength training. It's incredible. Another feature of strength training is you don't need to do it very often. You just don't, because the benefits come from the adaptations and not the calorie burn. I don't have to do it all the time. I just have to do it in a way that's effective so that it tells my body to build muscle. And for most people, 2 days a week is plenty. When you get more advanced, 3 days a week. When you're really advanced, 4 days a week. Really. I mean, you get crazy 5 days a week or more, right? But for most people, 2 days a week of good, well-programmed strength training, you have so far you can go with that. You can get really strong. You can really sculpt your body, really see this great metabolism boost. So it doesn't take a huge commitment of time to get these incredible adaptation results. And then earlier you mentioned the word toned from my book. We should talk to that for a second, because a lot of people don't know this, right? Toned, the literal definition of tone, it's a medical term and it refers to a muscle's ability to contract, okay? Basically, it's connection to the central nervous system, I guess, to put it plainly, to make it simple. Toned in the media space means feeling tight, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Muscles don't do that. Muscles build or they shrink. They don't tone. That's a totally invented word by the fitness industry to attract women to buy gym memberships, because they're like, I don't want to build muscle. Don't worry, you're just going to tone. There's no such thing. They either build or they shrink. Oh, and my other favorites are, do this workout program. It builds long, lean muscles, as if you could change the length of your muscles through exercise.
Yes. Can you debunk that a little bit for me even further? Because there are so many women that want to do some type of dance cardio, Pilates dance, lightweight, high rep. And that term is pretty much like, it's just part of that industry. And I love all different types of workouts. Like, I'm looking for my clients. You're definitely a specialist or an expert in building muscle mass. It's been something you're doing for very long time, and programming workouts and things of that nature. And I want to kind of get deep into what that might look like after we talk about this, but I just want my clients to work out. Like, I want them to move. I want them to love to move. I want them to do what makes them stay consistent, get consistent. But that type of workout has been coined as something that creates long, lean muscles, yeah. Air quotes.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. So first off, I want to be very clear. Any exercise, any form of activity, so long as it's appropriate, is good. There's benefit to it. And a consistently done form of activity let's say we have two forms of exercise. One is inferior to another one in terms of results, but the one that you do that is consistent is the superior one for you. So if you love dance so much that you're going to be consistent with it for the rest of your life, that's it. Do that form of exercise. So I am not a zealot when it comes to forms of exercise. Do what you love. It helps build a good relationship. It helps you stay consistent. That's going to give you most of the benefit. The reason why I talk about strength training so much is because it's so stigmatized, and also because I know that the average person isn't going to do 4 or 5 different forms of exercise. Ideally, they would do strength training. They'd have a yoga practice. There'd be meditation in there. I know most people will do one thing 2 days a week. And so I say, okay, this is the most effective one. Let's try doing that one. Okay, so let's talk about this whole long, lean thing. First of all, you can't change the length of your muscles. You're born with your muscle attachments, and that's it. The only way to make them longer would be to surgically remove an attachment and then reattach it somewhere else. I don't recommend that. So the shape of your muscles, you can alter to an extent big muscles. I can like maybe focus more on upper chest or lower chest or different musculatures of the back. But for the most part, as a muscle develops, it's your genetics determine its attachments and where it how it looks type of deal. So, and you know, by the way, one of my favorite benefits of exercise is acceptance. It's wonderful because if you stick to this long enough, you accept this is how my body is. And so I'm just going to keep going. I'm not going to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I remember accepting that as a teenage boy. No matter what I do, I'm not going to look like it, right? So, so that's a great benefit. Okay, so where does this myth come from? Well, if you look at an athlete, a top athlete, they have you tend to notice a trend in how they look. And so it's natural for us to think that, well, the form of exercise is making them look like that. That's not what's happening. So let's use a different form of exercise because it's easier to illustrate this. Let's look at swimming. Okay. Michael Phelps, the most winningest swimmer of all time in the Olympics. I mean, just an absolute phenom. Let's look at his body. Okay. I think he's like 6'5 or something like that, 6'4, 6'5. But his legs are as tall as like the average 5'11" man. And his arms are as long as someone who's something like 4 inches taller than him. He has a flat rib cage, wide shoulders. Did swimming form his body into that? No. His genetics made him the perfect boat or whatever in the water.
Perfect swimmer, yeah.
Swimmer. And then his training added to that. And so when you get to the top level, what you see is dedicated, consistent, good training athletes who also have the genetics that make them really good at their respective sports. Like look at a long distance runner, compare them to a top level swimmer, and you'll see the opposite. Long distance runner champions have really long legs, short torsos, swimmers, long torsos, short legs. So when you look at dancers, high level dancers, well, they look a particular way. They have this kind of long, lean look, like a almost like a ballerina or a dancer with the long lines or whatever. So part of that's technique, but a large part of that is their genetics. You could train like them all you want. And if you're built like a shot putter, you're not going to look like a ballerina, you know, a top level ballerina. So that doesn't necessarily work that way. Now, can you shape and sculpt your body to an extent? Yes. Strength training is great at that because it allows you to target specific areas of your body. I want more butt. I want more shoulder. I want to work on posture. I can focus specific areas of my body, but you can't get around your genetics either. So there are definite limitations. But no, when it comes to developing muscle, your body will develop it and it's going to look how it's going to look as it develops. And you can't make a muscle look long and lean. You just have long, lean muscles and then maybe you get lean and that's why you can see them.
Right. I love that you said that exercise creates acceptance. I feel so fortunate that my parents put me into sports as a young girl and that I have a little bit of muscle memory that I've been able to maintain since way back in the day through pregnancies and things of that nature. But, you know, getting back out there after, say, 10 months of being pregnant and trying to lift and work out and move my body through it, but always towards the end, third trimester, just being like, oh, okay, well, I'm moving, I'm still working out. And then having that postpartum and coming back, hopefully with a vengeance, if the sleep's good. What would be your advice? Because now that we've sold people on building muscle, because who doesn't want to have food freedom, be able to calorically eat more, have better posture, have, you know, nice physique, what would you suggest? Is there a time of day we should be working out? You said 2 to 3 days a week, which I love because that's attainable for people. Yeah. When someone says you have to work out every day of the week or 5 days a week, that consistency isn't going to happen. So you also mentioned to have good programming. So if you were to program someone's diet, say someone like me, so I'm 38 years old, I have 2 young kids, I can get 2 workouts in a week. How long do they need to be? Am I switching muscle groups? Am I doing a full body? Like, what does it look like really?
Yeah. So, first off, time of day, the time of day that works best for you is the best time to work out. Okay. So long as it's not like interrupting your sleep. Like, I don't think you should
9 PM.
Yeah. Like, you know, get, you know, 4 hours of sleep because you have to get in your workout type of deal or whatever. But, any time of day is fine. Studies will show you perform better at certain times and others. Doesn't matter. We're splitting hairs. The time of day that works best for you. is it the best time of day to exercise? Now, I have personally seen more consistency with people who start their day with exercise, but I think that just has to do with the fact that less things get in the way. So you start your day that way, less, you know, especially when you have kids. I have kids too. I have three kids. And you know how it is when your day gets low, oh, crap, I got to go. I can't work out now. I have this happen or whatever. But if I start my day that way, then it tends to not get in the way. But nonetheless, doesn't matter. Okay, programming. Let's talk about that. So what we want to do is, number one, we want to pick the most effective exercises possible. Okay, the ones that give you the most bang for your buck. So in other words, I want to do the one exercise that's going to give me, in the short period of time that I work out, the results that I would get if I did the next five exercises together for the same part of my body or whatever. And there definitely is a hierarchy of exercises in terms of effectiveness as defined by how well it increases strength. Is this going to speed up my metabolism? Is this going to increase my functional or my real world strength? In other words, it's great to get stronger in the gym, but am I going to feel stronger when I move boxes or when I lift the couch or when I play with my kids, right? Is it going to reduce injury? Is it going to make my joints feel better? Like that kind of stuff, right? And so there definitely is a hierarchy. Your best bang for your buck exercises are squatting, barbell squatting or body weight squatting or forms of squatting are excellent. There's lots of forms of squatting, but your traditional squat is one of the best. Deadlifting. Okay. This is what we call a hip hinge type movement. This is lifting something off the floor. Great for the hip, lumbopelvic hip complex, right? So this is the hips, the back strengthens the back and make it bulletproof if you do it right. So you don't hurt your back. That's a great exercise. Pressing movements, horizontal pressing, vertical pressing, right? Pressing overhead, pressing in front of me, works lots of different muscles, produces great results. Rowing, right? Pulling things to my midsection, right? Helps with posture, which these muscles that pull the shoulder blades down and back, so important nowadays because we spend so much time sitting on couches with things in front of us. Yeah, that, you know, forward head and forward shoulder, which is what it sounds like, right? Mm-hmm. Super common, causes tightness in the neck. So if you feel tension in your neck, it's probably because these muscles aren't very strong and other muscles have to do more of their job in order to support your shoulder structure. So you have this kind of tension all the time. So rowing, pulling your body up or pulling things down, right? So being able to, like, a pull down or pull up is really important. Something that involves rotation, really important. I mean, we're pretty much done, okay? Now, there's lots of variations in there, but we're pretty much done. Start with the more challenging exercises in your workout, move down to the kind of easier ones. Honestly, you're looking at four to five exercises, you know, 2 or 3 days a week. And here's the important part. And I'll tell a story to kind of, I guess, illustrate where I came up with this. You know, years ago, I live up in Northern California. We had these wonderful foothills up here. Great hiking, great walking. And I would go up there on occasion to go walk. Beautiful weather. Let me go do some, you know, some activity. And I remember one time I was up there walking. And I was doing a long hike. It was probably a three-hour one. And every half hour or so, a runner would pass me up. Now, as a trainer, it's really hard for me not to notice biomechanics. It's just, it's like a tailor. You know, every suit that comes by, they can notice, you know, certain things or whatever. So people would run by me and I'd be like, oh man, their feet are pronating so bad. Or, oh, that's a really strong.
Don't judge, Sal.
Anterior pelvic tilt. No, just as a trainer, you know, I'm like, oh man, that person's going to hurt, you know, but I'd leave people alone. I'm not that kind of person. But
I know.
But, you know, so I'd see feet would pronate or supinate or, you know, this really strong arch in the back called an anterior pelvic tilt, or you'd see really bad forward shoulder. And just people, you know, kept running by and saying, oh my gosh. And then this person ran by, they looked like a gazelle. They were just so smooth, perfect. It looked like it was effortless with how they were running. The biomechanics were perfect. And then I thought to myself, I said, you know, humans, we evolved. We're not very physical creatures. I mean, we're known for our intelligence, but there's a few things that we do really well physically. We can throw with accuracy really well, and we can out trek or outrun for distance almost any animal. This is true. This is how we hunted. We'd wound an animal, we'd run after it. I said, why are people running? Why do we run so bad then? It's like, well, we just lost the skill. Like, we're 10 years old, we stop running. And we lose the skill of running. And then we pick it back up when we're 30 and we decide we're going to go running to work out. And we've completely, imagine if you stopped, you know, walking for 15 or for 5 years, right? How weird it would be to start walking. And, but that's not the only problem. The next part of this problem is people don't say, you know what? I'm going to start running. I got to practice the skill of running. Nobody says that. They say, I'm going to go work out. So what do? They run until they're tired. Well, man, if your running was bad to begin with, it's worse when you're fatigued. That's when form goes out the window and technique and biomechanics go out the window. So here's my advice to people when they do strength training. Treat it like a skill, not like a workout. So when you go to the gym, you're not squatting to make your legs sore or to make your butt, you know, burn or whatever. Go practice squatting. Get really good at it. You're not pressing to work your triceps and your shoulders. Go practice your pressing. Go practice the skill of rowing. Treat your workouts like that every single time you exercise. Now, you definitely want to pick a weight that makes it feel challenging, but you want to, the priority should be practicing the skill. Perfect the skill. And what'll happen with that is your risk of injury goes down. You'll train with much more appropriate intensity, because people who go with the intention of, I'm going to hammer my legs, the intensity is always too high. Form goes out the window and forget it. Go and practice. So what I recommend in my book is go to the gym, pick 4 or 5 of these exercises and go practice them. Go do 3 or 4 sets of squats. Get really good at perfect squats. Now go do some presses. Get really good at pressing. Get really good at rowing. And this leads to phenomenal long-term success. It's exceptional success compared to the workout mentality where I'm going to go in there, I'm going to beat myself up. So if, to be more specific, if I were to put together a workout for someone, one day may start with squats, then we would go with a row of some type, maybe a cable row or a band row or a body row or a dumbbell row. Then I would do some kind of a press, dumbbells or a barbell or a push-up. That's also a press. Then I would do some kind of an overhead lift where you can press dumbbells above your head or use bands, or if you're into yoga, you could do a handstand type of an exercise. Then I may do some type of a rotational exercise with bands, maybe a plank or a crunch, proper form, you're done. Then maybe the next time you go in, I might replace some of those exercises. Instead of squatting, I'm going to have you do a deadlift. Instead of doing a push-up, well, now this time we're going to do a dumbbell press, but similar type of movement pattern. And just practice them. Just practice the lifts. And people will be blown away by how good it feels. Here's another point I'd like to make. You should, and this one blows people away because they have such terrible ideas around exercise. You should feel more energized and better after your workout than you do before. Okay? You should not finish your workout and feel like you just survived like a beatdown. You should not feel that way. Now, I understand the occasional value in pushing yourself and whatnot. I get that. It's true. But 9 out of 10 of your workouts, especially if you're a beginner, I'd say 10 out of 10. But if you get more advanced, 9 out of 10 of them, you should leave the gym or be done with your workout and be like, man, I feel better than I did when I started. I feel like I could do 4 more of those. I feel incredible. I feel like I could tackle my day. That's how you should feel at the end of your workout. And that will point you in the right direction. Feeling like you just got beat up, I promise that's only going to last so long before you either want to stop, before your body forces you to stop.
Absolutely. And it gives people such gym anxiety or workout anxiety when they're constantly leaving feeling that way. Because where is the, when in connecting how you feel to what you did, they're then connecting this negative feeling and maybe feeling nauseous or sick or depleted or they have a headache. They're not going to want to go back to the gym. Well, but the opposite gets them going.
Yes. Well, actually, it's even deeper than that. They went into it with the wrong mentality. Most people do not start a workout routine or a diet because they think to themselves, you know, I need to take care of me. I deserve to be taken care of. I love my body. Therefore, I want to take care of it. Most people don't do that. Most people go into it the opposite. I hate my body. I'm fat. I'm gross. I'm not sexy. I'm lazy. I'm whatever negative description you can think of. So now I'm going to go to the gym to fix this negative thing. And you know what that becomes? A punishment. Mm-hmm. You are not in the gym to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. You're in the gym because you don't like something about yourself and you're going to try and fix it and you're punished. You're beating your, this is why people beat the crap out of themselves because I ate that burrito yesterday. I'm going to sweat it out, right? I'm going to beat myself up. With diet, it becomes restriction. Mm-hmm. It doesn't become self-care. It becomes, you don't know, you can't have that cookie. No, you can't eat that. You're going to eat this bland stuff because that's what you deserve. That's all you're going to eat. And this is it. And this is what we're going to do. And you know what that leads to? Rebellion. Mm-hmm. It leads to rebellion. Here's my evidence. Nobody goes off a diet and then just kind of goes off. They go way off, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody goes off and says, yeah, I ate an Oreo. Like mm-hmm. I ate the whole box of Oreos. I just went, it's a rebellion. It's like the pendulum had to go in the complete opposite direction. Here's more evidence of what I'm talking about. How many times have you talked to somebody who started an exercise program, started a diet or whatever, and they are consistent. And then maybe you run into them a while later and you say, hey, how's that workout going? And they go, oh, I stopped because I just want to enjoy life.
You know? Sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but like that happens a lot.
All the time. Let's examine the absurdity of that. Now, I understand it, by the way. I don't want to criticize anybody, but here's how absurd it is. You stopped improving your health. You stopped doing something for you that by all metrics improves the quality of life. You stopped doing it because you wanted to enjoy your life. Why? Because that was a punishment. You viewed it as a punishment. You treated it as a punishment. Of course you stopped. Anybody who's going to keep doing that? That's where the motivation goes away and you're not motivated to beat yourself up anymore. And you want to stop doing it. If you go into it with the mentality of, I'm going to perfect the skill of exercise. I want to learn how to do this stuff. That's a positive thing. And you know what? I want to take care of myself. Like I deserve to be taken care of. I deserve to feel what it feels like to be healthy. Okay. That'll lead you in the right direction. When you go into it with that mentality, let's say you had a stressful day at work and you're real tired and you know, today you're supposed to go to the gym and you walk into the gym. You're like, I am exhausted. Kids woke up twice last night, stressful at work. I'm super tired. I know I got to take care of myself. You know what that means? I think what I'm going to do today is I'm going to walk on the treadmill and I'm going to stretch. I think that's what I'm going to do to take care of me today, right? Versus, kids woke up two times last night and stressful day at work. But you know what? I'm still, I got to just beat myself up. I'm just going to go beat myself up in this class and let me drink a Rockstar and get energized and go hammer myself, right? So it leads to long-term success. You can't enter it from a place of self-hate because if you do, you're not going to hate yourself forever. I promise. At some point you're done with it and then you stop.
You have a holistic approach. You're definitely an expert in putting muscle on, and muscle gives us the flexibility in our diet. But what does self-care through nutrition look like for you and for your family? And how do you act as a model and expose your kids to nutrition?
Yeah. Well, nutrition, in my experience, my best success came from approaching it from a behavioral standpoint, not from the mechanistic actions of diet. So mechanistic actions would be, proteins, fats, carbs, calories, you eat less than you're taking in. Here's your meal plan.
Counting, weighing, measuring.
Yeah. Packing. Yeah, exactly. Now, I think there's value in knowing what's in food. So I think you need to be informed. Because without information, we can be a little bit ignorant, right? So understand those things. There's nothing wrong with that. But now let's go from a behavioral standpoint. So here's an example. And I used to do this with clients. And it was so funny because they'd be shocked at the results that they get, not realizing the approach that I had or why I had a particular approach. So I'll give you an example, right? I'll give you two scenarios. Scenario one. You're coming in, you want to lose weight. So I tell you, here's what I want you to do. Let's have you eat 600 calories less a day. Okay. That'll put you at a calorie deficit and you'll lose weight. So that's one option. So track, let's count calories. We're cutting you 600 calories a day. Here's scenario two. Listen, I want you to eat until you're satisfied. Eat, don't eat until you're stuffed, but eat until you're satisfied. I only want one thing though. Let's avoid heavily processed foods. So those are foods that come in wrappers, boxes, long shelf lives. Let's avoid those. Let's try to stick to whole natural foods, but eat until you're satisfied. Okay. Now, both of them result in the same thing. This one, you eat 600 calories less a day through counting and tracking. This one, you eat 600 calories a day on accident. Now, where's this coming from? And by the way, this is, again, backed by studies. Heavily processed foods are engineered to make you overeat. They're so palatable, and they're engineered. They're like hacked. It's like they hacked our palatability through science. If you look at all the R&D that goes into these foods, 90% of it goes into making them irresistible to us. Okay, they're really, really good at doing this. They've done studies, and there's some really well done studies. Control, very hard to find controlled diet studies. Most of them are observational, which, if you ever ask somebody what they ate, you know, 2 days later, there's going to be things.
Do you even remember?
it's usually off. But these are controlled, meaning they brought people into a lab and watched them. And this is what they did. They said, okay, we have two groups of people, two rooms. We'll control for, make sure there's similar macro breakdown. So similar amounts of proteins, fats, and carbs. This room, only whole natural foods. This room, only heavily processed foods. And then they said, eat as much as you want or as little as you want. And they watched them. They counted the calories for them. And then they took the groups. And this is my favorite part. They switched rooms. They took this heavily processed food group room and or group, and they put them in the other room and vice versa. And then they watched and counted them, the calories. And what they found was, on average, people eat about 600 more calories a day when they eat primarily heavily processed foods. So I know, as a trainer, behaviorally speaking, if I tell someone, avoid heavily processed foods, but eat as much as you want, that is a better approach than count your calories, eat 600 calories less a day. And people would trip out over this. They would come back to me and we, oh my God, you're dropping body fat. You're losing weight. They're like, but I don't get it, Sal. I'm eating fruit and nuts and I'm eating steak and all this food. I feel stuffed. You know, how is this possible? Like, what's the magic? You know, and I'm like, we're eating less calories. No, I'm not. Like, yeah, you are. You're actually eating less calories. You just don't realize it. I'll give you a great example. I heard this example from Chris Kresser. We had him on the podcast a while ago and I loved it. He said, if I took five plain baked potatoes, no salt, no butter, nothing, and I gave them to you and I said, eat these in an hour, right? You wouldn't be able to do it. It'd be very difficult. Most people would gag after the second or third.
Baked potato.
But if I gave you a bag, a family size bag of Lay's potato chips, you'd probably be able to do it in an hour. Same amount of potatoes. Same. Big family size bag of Lay's potato chips. I think he's got about four baked potatoes. And by the way, it's more calories in the Lay's potato chips than the baked potatoes. But you can eat this one because they've designed it to be so darn palatable. So behaviors, right? Here's another one. I could tell somebody to cut their calories 10%. Let's find out your calories. Let's cut 10% out. Let's have you track, whatever. Or I could say this. Eat like you normally do. Here's what I want you to do, though. Every meal, don't watch TV. Don't be on your phone. Don't read a book. Don't be distracted. Just you and your food. Okay. Now, why would I say that? Studies show that people consume about 10 to 15% less calories by simply not being distracted, by simply being present with their food, right? So that's another example. I can also, here's another one, one of my favorites. I would tell people, I'm going to have you aim for protein. So what I want you to do is, and I would only have them track protein. I'd say, I want you to eat, let's just say 30 grams of protein with breakfast, lunch, and dinner and eat it first. So eat your protein first, and then I don't care what you eat for the rest of the meal. Now, protein is very, very satiating. It's the most satiating macronutrient, and it naturally results in eating less calories, naturally. And I know they're going to get their fats because proteins typically compared with fats. Carbohydrates are not essential, so if they eat lower carbs, no big deal. If they eat more carbs, fine, but they tend to eat less because protein is so satiating. Here's another strategy. I write about this strategy in the book, which I really appreciate. It was very effective for my clients. We all have those trigger foods, okay? We all have foods that it's like, man, if it's around, it's going to be really hard for me to resist.
Yeah, watch out.
Yes. Like for me, it's chips, any kind of chips, but especially potato chips. If they're there, it's like, it's very difficult to have the discipline to avoid, especially if they're next to me, right? All day long. So identify your trigger food and don't tell yourself you can't have it. Just create a barrier between you and that food. Okay. My favorite barrier is to not have it in the house. But if you want it, you drive to the grocery store and you get yourself a serving of it. So if I want potato chips, I I don't say I can't eat potato chips. I say, I'm going to drive to the grocery store, get myself a single serving bag of potato chips. Now, what ends up happening is I usually don't get it because I say, you know what? I really want the chips. And I put my pants on, put my shoes on, you know, start to get ready. Now I've got time between the impulse, right? And I give myself
some space.
Yes. And I have some space of awareness. And then the awareness sets in. I go, do I really want it? I really don't want it that bad. You know, I don't think I'm going to get it, right? But I've also given myself permission. It's like I said, I can't. I just created the space for awareness. So these are the things that I like to employ, and they just have the greatest success. I do one with activity as well. Like I know that daily activity is extremely valuable. Any activity, right? Walking is my favorite form of activity because most people can still do it, and most people can do it with decent biomechanics. So I can tell them to do it every day. But instead of telling people to carve out 30 minutes a day to do a walk on the treadmill or whatever, instead what I do is I pair it with an activity that they do daily anyway, which is eat. So I say, hey, after breakfast, lunch, and dinner, go for a 10-minute walk. I can do that, no problem. 30 minutes of walking right there. And I paired it with a ritual that they normally do. And I found great success with that. So people tend to do these 30-minute walks, 10 minutes a time, each one attached to breakfast, lunch, and dinner. If they miss one, no big deal. They still did 20 minutes. But it's easier to stay consistent than to say, oh, I need that 30 minutes. I got to carve out to go do this, you know, do this walk.
Yeah, habit stacking. Very James Clear of you. And it's funny because it does work. And as a, you know, as a trainer, I'm sure you've seen like it is, it's about the behaviors. And you mentioned it earlier in the show. It's how do you stop those knee-jerk reactions to do something like grab a bag of chips? You create a barrier. How do you get yourself moving? You add it and stack it to something that you're already doing every single day. And you don't make it this huge barrier to entry if it's something you want to do, which I love.
Yes. And you also, you know, and this is through no fault of our own, right? If you were born and raised lucky enough to be born and raised in a modern society, you grew up in a society where food was very, we have fixed the food problem from the standpoint of starving, okay? Mm-hmm. More people die of too much food than they do of not enough food in modern society. So we have all this food, huge markets for it. Markets are really good at giving us what we want. What do people want? Food that tastes good. So the top selling food in any category, even health foods are the best tasting foods, right? And so what we've learned over time on accident is to value food for its palatability, and pretty much it. Like that's pretty much how we value food, is how palatable it is, right? And it's like you have the conversation with your friends at lunchtime. What do you want to have for lunch? Mexican food. I don't know if I want that. What about Chinese? Yeah, maybe Chinese. Oh, I know this great Italian restaurant. So it's like you're basing your decisions off of the palatability of food. But this is like, it's not enough information to truly understand the true value of food. That is a value of food, but it's only one. There's also, how does this make me feel emotionally? How does this affect me physically? What are my emotional ties to this food? There's definitely foods that I have emotional connections to that, I mean, if I'm being truly objective, they're not really that delicious, but because my mom gave it to me when I was a kid, when I was sick or whatever. Like I remember when I was a kid, my mom used to buy, it's the worst tasting cracker of all time. It's called chicken in a biscuit. I don't know if you
remember. My mom used to buy that too, with a can of like chicken noodle soup and Campbell's and those two things together.
Yes. It is literally a cracker. That's like they took a chicken soup bouillon cube and sprinkled it on it. But I like it because when I was a kid, right. So, but that's a value of food, right? There's foods that we connect with people over. Mm-hmm. So really understanding all the values of food will help us make choices that are good for us, that serve us. Cause if it's only palatability, all we're serving is that. We're not serving the other stuff, right? So I'll give you an example that I've used on the show. I had this client once, and I'm sure she's heard me talk about her. I don't say her name, but she came to me and in terms of her diet, it was the most, I couldn't believe the stuff that, like her diet, I could not believe it. She didn't drink water, for example, no water. It was diet soda. That's all she had for fluids. Never had any vegetables at all. And so she came to me and I love her to death. And she's like, here's my diet and here's what I eat. And I said, okay, well, we're going to start where you're at and we'll slowly move in this direction. And there were a few small steps that we took. And one of them was, I wanted to increase her vegetable intake. She definitely needed some fiber. Her digestion wasn't great. And I said, okay, we're going to try eating more vegetables. She's like, I hate them. They make me gag. They're so disgusting. I said, okay, what's the one that you could tolerate the most, maybe? And she goes, maybe broccoli. I said, okay, here's what I want to do. I want you to have like two pieces of broccoli with lunch every day. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to pay attention to how you feel before, during, and after. I want you to notice how it makes you feel. I want you to, right? Over time, what she started to identify was that her digestion got better, that the broccoli made her kind of feel good when she ate it. Like, she's like, man, I feel better when I eat this broccoli. You know what happened? She started craving it. She started wanting to eat the broccoli. Now, this is part of human behavior. We don't just want things because they maybe taste good. We may also want things because we start to identify how they make us feel in different ways. So when you become aware of food in this way, like I had this one woman who every day she would take an antacid. Every single day by 1 p.m., she was taking Tums because she had heartburn. And it's interesting when you get, I'm sure you've seen this too, you'll get a client and you'll ask them, you know, do you have any digestive issues or do you have any pain? They'll be like, no, I'm totally fine. But then you go down the checklist, you know, it's like, okay, you don't have any pain. How about your neck, your shoulder? And oh yeah, my elbow hurts. So you start to notice things. So I asked her and she said, no, I don't have digestive issues. I went down the list and she takes an antacid every day. Well, we eventually identified that it was the bagel that she ate every morning for the last 15 years. Guess what she started not wanting or started to not like? The bagel. Because she finally connected it to this crappy feeling that she had in the early afternoon. So when you do, and by the way, food marketers do this for you. They do this for you. They make associations for you. For example, like, where's the most enjoyable place to eat popcorn, right? Movies. Mm-hmm. They did that very, very well, right? If you watch a beer commercial, it's always like at the beach and the, you know, the bikinis and the cool whatever, the party or whatever.
The Corona commercials.
No one's going to sell food and then show like bloated, like pain or whatever. Like, that
association, right? They should. There you go. Yeah.
But nobody would buy it, right? So my point is, this happens naturally when you start to allow yourself to become aware. So how do you do this? It has to be conscious at first. How do I feel going into this meal? Am I happy? Am I sad? Am I stressed? Am I anxious? How did I feel during this meal? How do I feel afterwards? How do I feel at night? How do I feel tomorrow? And what am I eating that's causing these things? And how's my skin look? And wow, my hair looks good. My digestion starts to feel a little better. Oh, my workouts, I have more energy. You start to make these connections. You'll find yourself naturally starting to crave the foods that serve you and naturally starting to not really want the foods that don't serve you. And that takes a little while, but let me tell you, I've never had to hyper motivate a client that enjoys eating healthy, right? Mm-hmm. If you enjoy it, it's just now there's your life. There's your lifelong success right there.
Absolutely. It's over time too. I think what you've highlighted, all of these action steps, whether you're linking things habitually or just getting people to see how they feel, like all of that over the long term, it just, you get better and better year after year. You have that muscle memory, you know the broccoli tastes good, and it just becomes easier and easier. It's not, which I have to repeat from the beginning, you said it's not going all in. It's not going all out. It's not feeling sick when you get out of your workout. It's like, how do you get to a place where you're loving what you're doing, where it makes you feel awesome, whether it's food or exercise or your lifestyle? And that, I mean, as a nutritionist and as a trainer, you know, like if they're intrinsically motivated because of the way that they feel and how they show up for their family and what they think about themselves and their physique and their energy levels and their brain, like there's nothing, you can't replace that. That is priceless.
And I do want to be clear that the comparison is not fast results to slow results. The comparison is no results to results, because I don't know anybody that wants to lose 20 pounds and gain it back and then some. Okay. Nobody wants to do that, right? We want it gone forever. We want fitness. There's only one way to get results, and that's forever. And this is the way to do it. And yes, it is a slower process, but I do want to be very clear. It's faster than you think. You know, if I take two parallel lines and I move one 2 degrees, like if I look here, they look pretty close to each other. Follow those two lines for a mile and you'll see how far apart they are, right? It's compounding. The results are compounding and it feels much more effortless. And again, I can't stress this enough. It's permanent. It's forever. Like this is now how I live. But of course it's a process. You can't, like, good luck changing foundational parts of your life overnight. That's not going to happen. It just, you know, unless you have an epiphany, which those are very rare and they usually happen from, you know, tragedy. It's a process of growth again, and we'll get a little esoteric. The process of health and fitness is a wonderful personal growth process. There's so much you learn through this process. It's a journey. It's a great one. It's a fun one. But again, the results happen faster than you think. So don't think to yourself, oh my gosh, if I do it the right way, it's going to take me 10 years. No, it's not going to take you 10 years. It's a lot faster than you think. And you'll enjoy the whole process.
It's all about the journey. It's all about those daily yes. behaviors. Just think about how much happier and joyful you feel leaving a workout that makes you feel like you could do it 4 more times. Sal, absolutely. You are amazing. I'm so glad to have you on the podcast. Your book, The Resistance Training Revolution, is out. You have an amazingly popular podcast called Mind Pump with a bunch of your buddies. You have amazing guests. I mean, you mentioned Chris Kresser even on the show. He's also been a guest here on the Be Well by Kelly podcast. Really, really the primo top of the top health expert. So thank you for being here and being one of ours. I'm going to put everything in the show notes, but where can people follow along?
Yeah. So just Mind Pump. So any platform, any podcast platform will have us. And then of course the book can be found anywhere where they sell books.
Awesome. Well, we will link to everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at bewellbykelly.com and follow me on Instagram at bewellbykelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.